Hey, everybody. Can you guys hear me all right? Is that, that's a good level? Okay. So, can everyone else hear me okay? Can you see Heather okay? Okay.
Oh, boy.
So we're going to do things a little bit differently here this morning. Jenna and I are both going to be sharing and giving the message this morning. We've been having a lot of conversations this week about our text, which is about Thomas, a.k.a. Doubting Thomas, from the Gospel of John.
My favorite.
Yeah, me too. It's like my patron saint. And so we kind of thought we would sort of give the message together. It's kind of unclear to even us at this point. Is this a co-sermon, or is this like a conversation that we're having and you have to listen to it? Well, I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah, this is like On Being with Krista Tippett.
It is. Can I be Krista?
No, I want to.
Okay. All right. So we're going to start with our text, you know, like normal people would do with a normal sermon. And then we're going to share some thoughts. So this is from the Gospel of John, and we're picking up the story just after the resurrection, and Jesus appears to Mary, and then Jesus appears to the disciples in the locked room. Now, this is John 20, starting at 24. But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. And although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
So, should I go first?
Go for it.
Okay. So one thing that I notice and appreciate about the resurrection appearances in the Gospel of John is that you have this like central event that is like so important to Christianity, the resurrection of Jesus. But then you also have different people's different reactions to that, right? So it's like a couple examples. You have like the other disciple, the beloved disciple
who also happens to be named John. So I think there's a little bias in the writer there.
I think so. Yeah. Wants us to think pretty highly of him. If you might remember from the text last week, he kind of brags that he's the first one to believe, right? He can't help but like note that fact. And so he's kind of the first like style of believer, right? So he looks in the empty tomb, he sees the grave clothes, and he's like, boom, I get it. I understand everything. I believe. It's very simple, I think, for John. Mm-hmm. And then you also have Mary, who is also at the empty tomb, mm-hmm. but her experience is very different than John's. She doesn't see things or believe things the way that John does. And it seems like a lot of that has to do with her emotional state, I feel like. She's grieving, but she's also angry. I think angry at, she thinks someone has stolen Jesus' body, so I think she's angry at that, angry at the injustice of the cross, and maybe angry at God. I mean, nothing worked out. I mean, right. Everything that they were hoping for kind of failed, and so she's in this very troubled emotional state, and I think that makes it difficult for her to believe the way that John does. Mm-hmm. And just listening to our prayer request this morning, and there's a lot of darkness out there that are in our lives and the lives of people around us. So I think a lot of us could probably resonate with Mary. And then you have Thomas, who's like, I mean, he's the consummate cynic, right?
Right.
He's like, I'm not going to believe. And seeing is not even enough. I need to put my finger in his jagged nail hole, like, until I believe, that's what the kind of evidence that I need. to believe. And so his is almost more of kind of like a rational, I guess.
Yeah.
Like he needs.
Yeah,
like
this
evidence.
Is my Easter today. So happy Easter to Jen. No, yeah, because I love Thomas because he's out there. All the disciples are locked in a room in fear of the authorities and in fear of just not really knowing what to do. And they're just kind of huddled in the dark. And the door's locked and it's real dramatic. And Thomas is out there like doing stuff. I mean, who knows what he's doing? I mean, maybe he's just like, well, that didn't work. Let's go back to work. Or maybe he's, you know, like, well, I guess I better remind my kids they have a dad. Or, like, maybe he's out there saying something about God. Maybe he's out in the world engaging in the world while all the other disciples are kind of huddled in and cowering, I picture them. And so I think that Thomas gets a lot of, he gets real negative, gets a lot of negative views because, you know, we often think that you have to, like, just have this blind faith, like, that doubt is just this awful, evil thing. And so really, I don't know, I just want to, like, bring Thomas great again. Make Thomas great again.
Someone keep a tally of the Trump references. We're at one so far. Well, I really like that idea of Thomas being out in the world. And I like that a lot better than I was reading some commentaries this week about this text, and there was one that had a really hilarious kind of interpretation of this. He really wanted to take the fact that Thomas was out and not with the disciples in the room to be an argument for regular church attendance.
You never know what you'll miss.
Like, yeah, don't be like Thomas, because you never know what you're going to miss. Which I guess is an appropriate interpretation for the Sunday after Easter, which is notoriously a lightly attended Sunday. And think of all the people missing this amazing conversation
we're
having right now. Now, when I was reading through here, I was wondering about some of the words and the word choices. And my Greek skills, even though I passed Greek, are very poor. And so I directed some questions to Jen, who got an A+, I think, in Greek. And,
only because I have a resident Greek expert in my house. You all should get one. It's great. And so the cool thing about...
Dan. We're talking about Dan.
Yeah, Dan. That guy. So the cool thing about looking at this text from the original language perspective is that the word doubt is never used in this text. It's not there. They do use the word doubt in other places, so it's not like they didn't have the word or that they were trying to, I don't know, find a synonym for it or something. They had the word doubt, which is diastazo or diakrino. You can write that down. Those are the words that mean doubt, and the writer of John doesn't use these words anywhere in the quote-unquote doubting Thomas text.
I'm intrigued.
Yes. And so it is used when Peter tries to like walk on water, and then again in Matthew when Jesus appears after the resurrection and they worshiped, but some doubted. But in this particular text, it has more of a parallel, has more grammatical and vocabulary parallels to the text about the father who says, "I believe, help my unbelief." So it's a slight difference, and it's subtle, but I think it's really important. So in other words, what's really should be said here is instead of don't doubt, but believe, but don't be unfaithful, but become faithful. So instead of, don't be an unbeliever, but come to believe. So there's a dynamic and active and a process perspective on these words. There's a process idea to these words that you don't just arrive and then stay and put the check mark next to your name, that it's fluid and constantly changing and moving. You become this way. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I like that too. And as we were kind of like reflecting on that, Jen and I were both sharing a little bit with each other about like what that process of belief has looked like in our own lives. You know, Jen mentioned before, like there's a sort of like stigma attached to doubt and questioning in a lot of faith traditions. And I feel like, you know, there are probably a lot of churches that wouldn't be comfortable having their pastors get up and talk about, oh, these are experiences that we have had as well. Let's talk about them and also talk about how we feel like we came out the other side as having a different, different yeah, belief, but... Right.
We're still here working for a church.
Yeah, so we're still in.
We're still in.
We're totally still in.
We were going to have a doubt off to see like who would win the doubt off, but we decided.
No one wants to hear me sing. I don't know about
nope,
Jen.
Nope. We're good at doubting, not singing.
Not singing as much. But do you want to share a little bit about like what that experience has been like for?
Yeah. Oh, geez. okay. So, I grew up Catholic. Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. I lived right across the street from our church, so we didn't have any excuse for not going to church. I had a big family, big Catholic family. In high school, some of you may have rebelled with, like, you know, drinking and staying out past curfew. I rebelled and became an evangelical Christian. I started praying for my mom's salvation, and I was just sucked into this community. And so I started to just, doubt the structure that I had been born into. Doubt, you know, do these priests really know what they're talking about? Is this mass really the thing that will bring me closer to God? And so I kind of went on this really fundamentalist evangelical Christian perspective. And for a while there, it was really good for me. I felt loved. I was in community. But then when life started to happen, and I started to deal with some issues of depression and mental illness, and I would go back to that community and say, what is going on? Like, I know all the right things, and I have the right beliefs. Like, why do I feel this way? And so many of them said, well, it's because you're not doing your quiet times. It's because you're not praying enough. And if you just believed harder, you wouldn't, you know, need the meds. You wouldn't need... you wouldn't be so sad all the time. And so then that left me in a place of major doubt. Like, okay, that doesn't seem right. And so that was the thread that pulled everything out, and everything kind of fell apart. And so I stopped going to church. I stopped really thinking about God. I stopped, pursuing the spiritual life and just really, I don't know, like just dove into other things in life and set that aside. But it wasn't until, oh, this is a funny story. So Dan and I moved to Pittsburgh, and they're giving Dan a tour of the seminary because he's going to get his master's degree there. And they give him a tour and they show him all the things, and then we're driving out down the long driveway, and Dan says, well, what do you think? And I say, well, better you than me. And then 3 years later, I'm a full-time student, MDiv, going into ministry. So it's sort of like this, I guess in my life, again, like my faith has been really changing and dynamic. It's been a process. I haven't ever landed and stayed on one particular place, but it's sort of like the journey and the continually asking of questions and the constant praying of, I believe, help my unbelief.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think a lot of people can probably resonate with that experience of, I know you can, because I can think of conversations I've had with other people in this room who have been hurt by faith communities and, you know, good intentions, but difficult words, difficult actions that have created opportunities for doubt in your faith journey. That for me, that wasn't like my particular like struggle with doubt. Like, I think for me, a lot of it comes not as much from outside, but from inside. A lot to do with like my personality type. I don't know how much credence you guys give to like the Myers-Briggs personality test. I know some people think it's bogus, but I feel like it's really helped me understand some things about myself. And I'm an INTJ personality type. And one of the things about that personality type, I see another fellow INTJ. There's a Dan. Yes, INTJs unite. Yes,
introverted. Judging. Yeah.
Yes. Myers-Briggs. Yeah. Okay. So, Corinne, who is apparently a Myers-Briggs groupie, was just explaining. So, INTJ for me is introverted, intuitive thinking, and judging. So, it's about, it gives you a sense of where you get energy in the world, how you process information and feelings.
Whereas I'm an INFP, so you can compare. Introverted, intuitive, feeling, and perceiving.
So for like a TJ, which is thinking and judging, it's less about like emotions and feelings and more about thinking about systems and like how ideas either fit together or don't fit together. And so something that's very troubling for someone like me is like inconsistency and contradiction. And so trying to iron those sort of wrinkles out is like a preoccupation for someone like me. And so as like a young person in an evangelical community where there are folks who believe in a literal six-day creation, which seems to be in contradiction with everything that science tells us about how old the universe is, or folks who really believe that every detail in the scriptures is not just true, but historically factual and scientifically factual, it was very troubling to someone like me to try to reconcile these sorts of ideas. And so that's what kind of created crises of faith for me, especially when I went to college and kind of got out of the bubble of like my home and like my church and started learning things from different perspectives. It definitely was like time to reevaluate and see what is it that I believe, and what are some things that I might want to let go of. And one of the things that, it was a very troubling experience for me, like I definitely experienced that as like a spiritual crisis. And one of the things that's given me a lot of encouragement is something that the Christian poet Christian Wiman has said in talking about strong faith. One of the things that he helped me understand is that you know, we value strong faith for really good reasons, but sometimes we mistake certainty for strong faith. Certainty and strength are not necessarily the same things. Like if we think about this in terms of like athletic strength, part of that is like, you know, force, but part of it is also flexibility, right? Like someone who is physically strong is also flexible, whereas certainty is very brittle and can snap under a certain amount of pressure. But a strong faith is not just strong, but also flexible and able to accommodate new information and change. And so whereas I felt like I was having weak faith and that was something that was to be ashamed of, what I found is that by pushing through that process and trying to learn and be shaped by it, I felt like I actually came out with a stronger, more flexible faith. So it was ultimately a good experience for me, but it was very painful at the time.
That's what I love about, she's my girlfriend. She doesn't know it, but she is, Nadia Bulls-Weber. She says that it's not always about, she thinks meaning is kind of overrated, or like, you know, belief as like a solid, stable thing is kind of overrated. And she says, my gosh, if God's going to wait till I mean it, that's going to be a while. So I think that the key is praying, not like feeling warm feelings towards people who've hurt you or towards your enemy. I don't think it's about feelings. I think it's about an action. And I think that action is commending them to the one who perfected the love of the enemy. And she says that's prayer, right? And so she talks along, further about you know, praying for enemies, even if you don't feel it. And our sense in the United States of like the sense of individuality, and it's like, I can only be saved if I believe the right things in a personal way, and then I'm saved. And she says that this kind of attitude is makes it inaccessible to people because, you know, maybe you've experienced this where you're like, I don't know if I believe this. And she uses the Apostles' Creed as an example. She says that lots of people say, I can't say the creed because I don't know if I believe every line in the creed. And she says, I'm like, oh my God, nobody believes every line of the creed. but in a room of people, for each line of the creed, somebody believes it. And so we're covered, right? So it's more of a sense of community, that faith is best embodied in community and not so much in the strict individual. Although that's good, I think, to have like a strong individual faith. I think that it's not full or complete unless you're with you guys, with together, and that we're not all going to believe exactly the same things, but that we're going to work together as the body of Christ.
I really like that like idea. And one thing I like about it is that it changes the idea of what the purpose of the church is from enforcing a set of beliefs on people, yeah, and kind of policing that. Mm-hmm. And helps us focus more on like how do we create like a healthy environment where questioning is safe and okay, where we can ask questions, where we can talk about things, trade theories, and encourage ourselves like on the journey, mm-hmm, and not trying to act like we've all arrived and we need to get everyone else up to speed with us, but just treating it more as like a process, like, yeah, you were talking before.
It's a living word. It's a living, mm-hmm, faith. And, you know, the opposite of faith isn't doubt. I think the opposite of faith is sort of like an ambivalence. And so, like, doubt and faith, I think, come together really in really important ways. Because if it's certainty, it's not faith. If you're for sure of whatever it is, then you don't have faith in it. You're just certain.
And that thought brings me back to like the original text, right? Because so Thomas says, I'm not going to believe unless not just I see, but I actually touch and feel Jesus. But then when it actually happens, like when Jesus does show up, it's a little bit unclear in the text. Like, does Thomas actually, like Jesus presents himself and says, like, go ahead, like, here's what you wanted. But it's a little bit unclear whether Thomas actually does that or if it's just enough for him to see in that moment. And I've been thinking about that. I feel like you can interpret it probably either way. But what I feel better about is thinking that he doesn't actually reach out and touch, because if he had certainty, I'm not sure that he could have faith anymore. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a kind of certainty that no one gets. And so the sooner we can get comfortable with that idea, like the better off we're gonna be, right?
Right. And that segues into point number four. Mike.
Does it?
It does. which is the celebrate. We want to talk about the celebration of doubters. My original idea was for us to like sit up here and say these really, you know, crazy things that we don't believe, or these really normal things that we probably should believe, and then somebody else say, "No, you can't." You can't get kicked out of the church for that because that's in a Reformed tradition. that throughout history, there have been doubters and there have been questioners and there have been challengers that have pushed and pulled and stretched, and we become members of that great body. We become members of that great family where, you know, and these aren't just like, you know, little guys. These are like big guys.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's a lot of shame, I think, associated with doubting now, but a lot of people who have really helped the faith grow have started out from a point of doubting some kind of conventional wisdom in the church. So like a good example was like Martin Luther, right? He was like, I'm not sure the church can sell forgiveness for a couple of coins. I'm having trouble finding that in the text. And there was a lot of, that was a really risky thing for him to do. There were lots of like social consequences for him putting himself out in opposition to the church. People were trying to kill him. I mean, like people were like really mad that he would dare to question things like that. But we benefited from like his courage and standing up and saying, hey, I'm not sure that like we've really got that right. We've benefited from people who were like, I'm not sure the Earth is the center of our planetary system or that it's flat. It doesn't seem flat. And people are like, we're going to kill you. But now we understand, like, the sun is actually at the center of our solar system. Or even, like, I was thinking, too, like, you know, it wasn't that long ago, and it's actually still current in some Christian communities today where only men are viewed as having the spiritual gifts for teaching and for leadership. And it took like some really brave women and men to stand up and say, I'm not sure that you're right about that. And so there's a certain benefit to doubting in some circumstances. I think it helps our faith and our practice as individuals and as a community become more authentic mm-hmm. and better expressions of what it means to be Christian.
Would you say doubting often can lead you to truth?
I think if you honestly pursue doubt, open to new belief and experiences and knowledge, that's been my experience. Mm-hmm. That's actually led me to deeper faith.
Yeah. I like the whole ask, seek, knock thing. It's not profess and be sure and know all the answers. It's ask the questions and seek out for God and knock on the door and you'll be answered, and you'll see, and the door will be opened. And so it's not so much, definiteness, but a process of just asking and questioning and showing up.
Mm-hmm. I think it's like the difference between seeing faith as, let me back up. So I've been reading this book. It's a history of doubt. It's written by this philosopher, Jennifer Michael Hecht. And she has this idea in there that she borrowed from someone else. But it's this recognizing the fact that humans, we all have this fascination with mystery, with trying to figure things out. You know, it's why we like Sherlock Holmes and masterpiece mysteries and all that sort of stuff. But there's a couple different kinds of those. There's puzzles and there's mysteries. And she talks about a puzzle being something that has to be solved. Right, like your crossword puzzle in your newspaper, like there are just some answers and there are not other answers. You have to find the right answer to solve the puzzle. But then there are mysteries that aren't meant to be solved. They're actually meant to be enjoyed. And to me, it's almost like, did anybody watch Lost back when that was like popular? Yeah, right? It was like super fun because it was a mystery and you're like, what is going on? You get disappointed in the end when you find out. But in the meantime, for whatever 7 seasons or 8 seasons or whatever, people were like talking with their friends, having Lost viewing parties, trading theories, like making videos online. Like people were like living into the mystery of this world that was being created in Lost. And I feel like that's what faith is. Faith is not a crossword puzzle. Faith is people getting together and watching Lost. Which actually is even, now I'm thinking about, the word lost is even more apt of a metaphor than I was originally conceiving as we were bumbling around in the dark trying to find truth together. But it's that idea of community, I think, that is missing from the idea of a puzzle that an individual solves. So for me, faith is more of a mystery. And as I was reflecting on that, I was remembering, not so much in the Presbyterian tradition, but in the Catholic tradition and maybe the Methodist too, the Eucharist, the bread and the cup, is called the mystery of faith. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a real connection there because we believe as a community that when we come together for communion that Jesus is somehow present with us. People have lots of different ideas about what that looks like or what that means. And on any given Sunday, you might really feel that, and on other Sundays, you might not really feel it at all. But every week, we come back together and we share in the bread and the cup. And we are sharing in that mystery as a community together. And that's been really important in shaping my faith and doubt experience as well.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes comes from Simone Weil, who was a philosopher, and she says, you know, it's not a matter of doubting whether or not there's bread, but are you hungry? If you're hungry, then come, and then, you know, the bread is there. It will appear. And so that has been an important part of my journey, too.
And that's a great segue to communion.